This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This week on Witness History, we go back to 1981, when Kathy Flower was chosen to present the first major TV series to teach English in China. Shown at primetime several nights a week, Follow Me was watched by an estimated 500 million people. Witness History, the podcast that takes you to amazing moments in history, told through the eyes of the people who were there. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. In a moment, the 4.5 billion-year-old building blocks of life preserved on a small asteroid and brought back by NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission, a triumph of the US's space program. But much of the episode is taken up with fears that actions being taken by the new administration will damage US science.
NIH is literally the engine that has made America great. Nothing less than that.
More on that to come. NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission was a daring and successful attempt to touch down on a remote asteroid for just a few seconds, scoop up rock and grit from its surface and bring them back to Earth to learn the secrets they may reveal of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. We've talked here about the brilliance of the astronautics, but this week we learned of the triumph of the science that compounds within the rocks show that wherever asteroid Bennu ultimately came from had conditions that could cook up the molecules of life. The Natural History Museum's Sarah Russell was one of the international collaborators just bowled over by what they've seen.
We're really excited about it. So we were expecting, when we got the sample back, we thought it would contain a lot of water and we thought it would contain a lot of organic material, which it does. And we found that we saw that quite early on. But the thing that was really unexpected was that we also found this series of salt minerals. So they include things like sodium chloride, table salt, and lots of other salts as well. And we weren't expecting that because that's not what we see in the asteroids that we already have on Earth in the form of meteorites. And it sort of underlines that you really need a space mission to do this sort of work.
So when you say you're seeing salt, so this is actually little crystals, is it?
Little crystals, yeah, exactly. We see, I mean, they're really tiny.
And that's important because?
It's important because we think that these probably formed from a really briny fluid, so a really kind of salty little pond underneath the surface of the asteroid Bennu, which would have evaporated away and left those salts behind. And we think this might happen on Bennu 4.5 billion years ago, but it might be happening across the solar system today. So we see salt deposits that look a bit like we imagine these would have been on other asteroids like Ceres and on some of the moons of Saturn and Jupiter. But we haven't had them in the lab to look at before. So we're sort of excited because we think this might be something that actually happens quite a lot. But we just don't, it's difficult for us to look at them using the samples we've had before.
Let me get this straight. What you're saying is what? That there was water that was dissolving stuff and then moving around and then it was precipitating as it dried off or something?
Yes, exactly. So Bennu's parent body probably formed in the outermost part of the solar system, a mixture of ices and rock. And then it would have heated up in its early history and the ices melted and interacted with the rocks, first of all, dissolving all sorts of ions. And then the water started to evaporate away and left behind these what we call evaporite deposits, which are similar to what we see in salt lakes on Earth.
Right. I mean, that does sound to me quite exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, it is, right?
Well, no, absolutely, because it's sort of, it goes away from this idea that this is just a sort of a lump of rock that's sort of been orbiting, going around the, you know, it gives it a life, I suppose.
Exactly. So even though, you know, it's a really old rock, it's 4.5 billion years old, and, you know, to be honest, not much has happened in its recent history.
Yeah.
but in its early history, absolutely, it was very geologically active and had a lot of things happening to it. And the other exciting thing about these brines is that we think that this might have been a good location for cooking up organic molecules as well. So That's why we have our companion paper written by our organics colleagues talk about the organic component, Bennu, as well.
When you're talking organic, because I was about to come to that, these are amino acids. These are the simple building blocks of our proteins and so on. And they found quite a lot of them there.
Yes, they found a huge array of amino acids and also nuclear bases, which are one of the constituents in our DNA. So they found these, you know, pretty sophisticated organic molecules and molecules that might be important to help, you know, set us on the pathway to life.
I mean, as I recall, when Osiris Rex came back, it actually collected quite a lot of material.
Yeah.
Are all these amino acids and other things and your water, are they sort of all evidenced in one sample of this? Are they in different bits? Mm-hmm. You know, is this story in all in one grain, as it were, of the samples brought back?
Well, there's a huge team that's been working on Bennu. So there's over 200 scientists from across the globe have been looking at it and all looking at their own little bits. But in some ways, I mean, we all see slightly different things, but it's all part of the same story that I'm telling you, this kind of story of water action and formation of salts and then the formation of organics. This is a common thing across all of the samples of Bennu that we're seeing.
And I know the papers talk about the idea that these organic molecules and all these things could have been brought to Earth by comets and asteroids like Bennu in the deep past. In a way, I take a slightly different lesson from this. I don't know what you would think. It seems to show to me that these are molecules which will form all over the place, given half the chance. And that sort of, to me, raises the prospect of life elsewhere, not only in the solar system, but particularly elsewhere in the universe.
Absolutely, Roland. I completely agree with you. I think these are, you know, from what we're seeing, I would imagine these would be widespread processes. That's our hypothesis. I think it helps to be in the outermost part of the solar system where you have more available kind of volatile, low temperature things like water and carbon and so on. And so certainly these, I imagine, would have been widespread in the outermost part of the solar system. But then, yes, they impacted the Earth, but they would have also impacted Mars, for example, which would have been much more inherently habitable in its early history. So I think this, you know, potentially does have a lot of implications. And also, as you say, for exoplanets, planets around other stars, you know, all the things that we're seeing, we believe, are widespread and common processes. So there's no reason to think they wouldn't happen around other stars as well.
Astrobiologist Sarah Russell. The Bennu results were detailed in two papers shared by Nature Publishing this week. You can find the links on the Science in Action website. The success of the OSIRIS-REx mission is a testament, really, to the ambitions of NASA. But this was also the week the Chinese AI app DeepSeek tanked the price of investments in US IT companies, at the same time as the US science community was thrown into turmoil by a series of orders from the White House. For example, these headlines.
Trump hits NIH with devastating freezes on meetings, travel, communications, and hiring.
Chaos erupts in US science as Trump's team declares freeze on federal grants.
CDC staff order to cut communications with WHO after Trump executive order.
The CDC, Center for Disease Control, NIH, National Institutes of Health, FDA, Federal Drug Administration, they're just some of the huge federal health institutions directly targeted in a flurry of memos and executive orders. But also, there's the National Science Foundation, NASA, the US Geological Survey, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, just others which were caught up in the funding freeze, in the communications, travel and meetings ban, and in the actions against diversity, equity and inclusion initiatives. For instance, a small one, I learned of a group bringing together women engineers at Fermilab, a leading physics complex, who were told to cease their activities. And scientists across the country have reacted anxiously to the disruption. The Environmental Protection Agency, established in the 1970s under the leadership of Republican President Nixon, was particularly affected during the last Trump administration, and it's again in the front line in the new administration's war against red tape.
Okay, so let's just start with the executive orders. First of all, he declared under the National Emergency Act that the United States is in a national energy emergency. And as soon as he did that, it invokes a lot of powers for him to do things. So it allows him to say that this is an emergency. The domestic energy infrastructure is an imminent and pressing priority for national and economic security.
Which lets him overrule many existing environmental protections. This is Betsy Sutherland, a career official with the EPA until 2017, who keeps in close contact with many former colleagues whose job security is now reduced by another order.
What happens now in all federal agencies, including EPA, your career staff that are not politically appointed, just tired under a competitive system, it's our civil service protection. For decades, they have been protected from political patronage by having all kinds of protections, that you can't fire them without cause. And there's administrative law judges and so forth that look at, any punishment you give to a civil servant for lack of production or whatever. And certainly any firing is very tough to do, unless you pass all the requirements to prove that this person is unsuitable.
So you'd come out of university with a degree in hydrology or a degree in, ecology or something like that. You'd get a job at the EPA and you'd do the work you were asked to do.
Correct. And there is no way a political appointee, because we have, every 4 years, we have the potential for a new party to be in charge of the agency and have new political leadership. But the career staff, the vast majority of the people at EPA, EPA is what's called an independent agency. So it doesn't have all the many layers of political people that a big cabinet department has, like the Department of Defense or the Department of Energy or the Department of Labor. We're just a little independent agency, about 16,000 people. And there's, very few political appointees there that are Senate confirmed. So the career staff, scientists, engineers, and lawyers are generally protected from firing or any other retaliatory measures against them unless you can prove that they failed to do the mission that they were charged with. And there's all kinds of appeals processes. Well, what he wants to do, and he has this in the executive order, he tried to do it in his first administration and ran out of time. It's called a Schedule F. He's now calling it, a new job classification for career policy people, in which you would have no longer job protection from your political appointee, that the political appointee to EPA, if he or she decides that you're not implementing President Trump's agenda, he or she can let you go. And there's not the civil service protections. And he wants everyone now who can classify as a policy career person to be identified by every federal agency by next month. And so then when he removes the Biden rule protecting them, he can immediately put them in that job classification. And if the political appointees at EPA do not like what the person's doing, thinks that they're not sufficiently loyal to President Trump, they will fire them.
You presumably still in touch with some of your former colleagues at the
Absolutely.
EPA. What's the
yes.
mood?
So people are stunned. The current EPA employees, everyone that I've talked to wants to give it the first year of the Trump administration and see, how bad it's going to be before they decide if they're going to retire or not. The younger employees who are not invested yet in the retirement system are the most concerned because their issue is he has frozen all the funding for environmental projects nationwide, as well as, really taken over EPA and relooking at how they want employees to respond to presidential directives and so forth. And they think that this lack of funding is going to mean that their opportunity to go to an environmental consulting firm or to an environmental law firm will be really difficult because those firms are going to be affected by the fact that there's so little action on the federal government, there's so little funding on the federal government.
So it's not just the EPA, in a sense, environmental science across the states is likely to be impacted.
Correct. He has frozen all grants and all funding of environmental projects. And so, again, that's a real question, because supposedly under our Constitution, Congress controls the purse strings, and he has frozen money that the Congress has already appropriated and directed to be spent in certain areas. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But again, you can litigate this, but it takes, you know, years for the litigation to move forward.
And when you talk about environmental consultancies and legal firms and stuff, doesn't that, in a sense, speak to the Republican complaint that this is just a gravy train? This is loads of government federal money being splashed out to people who have a vested interest.
So I would respond that, you know, under the Biden administration, we finally have the, and it was called appropriately, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, because so much of our infrastructure, our water infrastructure, our highway infrastructure, our bridges, everything is really failing because we don't want to spend money on existing structures that need all this improvement. So this money was not going to, you know, wasteful projects. It was going to critically needed projects. You know, a bunch of money was going to replace all the lead pipes that take lead contaminated water into people's homes now. It was going to replace a lot of the bridges that need all kinds of work, all the roads. Everything that was going to be done was really going to make the economy boom, because it was going to give us the infrastructure necessary for that increased productivity.
But the red tape, the approvals and everything that the EPA represents, is that not a thing?
So everyone was interested in permit reform. That was a bipartisan interest, and it did have both Democrat and Republicans interested in doing it, but not the way the executive orders that Trump has signed are basically saying we're going to suspend all environmental protection rules. So the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Marine Protection and Sanctuaries Act, none of those environmental protections are going to apply. And we're just going to kind of, you know, approve these oil and gas projects without any oversight at all for their environmental impact. That's much more extreme than any bipartisan interest in, you know, speeding up permitting approvals.
Retired EPA specialist Betsy Sutherland, a member of the non-profit Environmental Protection Network. What became clear looking at social media was how broadly working scientists outside the immediate federal agencies were also being affected. Much of the US science we report here on Science in Action is financially supported by one of the agencies, NIH in health, NASA, or the National Science Foundation in astronomy. Similarly, climate science, nanotechnology, you name it. Their salaries and project funds depend on support which is approved at annual review meetings often held around this time of year, which have been abruptly suspended. Crystal Starbird is an early career biochemist supported through an NIH program called Mosaic. And she found that the initiative's website had gone dead overnight.
Mosaic is a transitional grant program, so it supports people from the postdoctoral phase to their early career faculty phase. So when I received the grant, it supported the last 2 years of my postdoctoral fellowship. And now as a new faculty, it offers support for the first 3 years through the R00 mechanism.
So that's a grant you've got, but you went to the webpage because...
You know, we heard that the diversity supplement program, which is another program through the NIH, was down and that the expiration date had been changed. And so I've heard a lot of people who have the Mosaic grant who are in the early phases, somebody who's just received it, et cetera, saying that they're really concerned about what's going to happen with it going forward, because it does have a diversity aspect to that grant. And so I went to the website to look at the page and see if there were any updates. And unfortunately, the page was down, which suggests that it may be, I don't want to speculate, but it may be taking a similar route to the diversity supplement. I think that's the concern.
So it's some sense that because it involves diversity, even though this is not a diversity program necessarily, but it's to support what kind of researchers?
Yeah,
is it all researchers, or is it people who have particular needs?
Yeah, so it's all researchers, but it does emphasize people who have a commitment to or are interested in advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion in science. So faculty like myself who spend a lot of time doing their really hard science, but also care about how we're mentoring trainees, care about, that the science that we have sort of is reflecting the populations that we serve, that we're thinking about things like health disparities. And so this grant is open to anyone, but is meant to highlight people who sort of care about those types of things in addition to their science.
So it sounds like that could be sort of deemed that it might be seen as something which is saying trying to give a lift up to people who might not otherwise get into academia.
Absolutely. But it's interesting to me, of course, because the grant, there's only one page of the grant, the diversity statement, that is actually related to diversity. The rest is purely scientific. And so the majority of the evaluation is the grant, the research proposal that you've written, the science that you intend to do. And so, it's, I guess with programs like me, it's interesting that they're really seeing them as purely diversity related potentially.
I mean, how important is the grant to you? I guess that University of North Carolina is paying your salary and so on.
Yeah, well, actually, I pay some of my salary off of the grant. As is typical for a school of medicine PI, we are in what's called, soft money positions where we're expected to use grants to support a significant portion of our salary. But my grant is also used to support the research in my lab. It's also used to support some of the trainees in my lab, their salaries. To somebody like me, it's critically important. I grew up extremely poor. I was on welfare in the United States. I was raised by a single mother who was addicted to drugs. And I was somebody who also did exceptionally well in school. But I can tell you that both financial concerns and sometimes racial concerns would have prevented me from continuing on my journey if I didn't have support from programs like these. I've mentioned Mosaic. By the time I got to Mosaic, to be honest, I think I was pretty firmly, committed in my career. But if we step back to an earlier stage, there's a program called PrEP, which is a post-bac program in the United States that I was a member of. I was actually the first cohort. And at that time, I was working at Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company. I had two children. I was trying to support my family out of poverty, and I didn't know if I was going to go back to graduate school. And then I heard about this program that helped people like me who had been out of school for a while to sort of adjust back to graduate school, to put in a competitive application. And importantly, it also paid you while you were doing it because I wasn't somebody who could afford to do a free internship, et cetera. And so I probably wouldn't have been here today as a successful new PI if not for the PrEP program. And it has nothing, the hard part that's lost some people is I was an exceptionally talented student. You can look in my record, it's fine. It's all very clear. I went on to graduate school. I published six papers, which is pretty rare in graduate school. And so there's no concern about whether or not I was qualified. However, the challenges that I faced coming from a low SES background would have prevented me from being successful in science if I didn't have additional support from programs like these.
These are being described as pauses and reviews and so on. So it may indicate what the administration is thinking in the future, but equally, these things could all be restored maybe in a matter of weeks or something. Is there any time criticality about any of this?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to answer this in two ways. One, the diversity supplement program has an expiration date that's been changed. So that is not a pause. That's an expiration. I suppose it's possible they could be planning another diversity supplement program to replace it. But given what I've heard, I doubt that that's the case. And so I want to emphasize that for some of these programs, already we're seeing not a pause, but essentially a termination of the program. I mentioned this in one of my earlier tweets about the pauses, but on a personal level, my mother-in-law was having just started chemo this week, and her chemo includes a biologic that was just approved a few months ago, so 4 months ago. In fact, at the doctor's yesterday, they were trying to figure out how they would administer it to her because the recommendations are so new, IV versus port, et cetera. My point was, and this surprisingly is a therapeutic that is based exactly on the type of receptors that my lab studies, right? So it's very, very personal to me. But you could imagine, and what I thought of when I thought of the pauses, is that pauses like this can sometimes cause a months-long delay in funding. And so imagine if there had been a months-long delay in that the pipeline of that drug, then my mother-in-law wouldn't be getting it this week, right? It's just very clear to me that pauses for critical things like cancer research can be really, really disruptive. And I've heard statements like, well, clinical trials are allowed to resume. I heard from some colleagues that they did stop for just a few days, but the clarity that came from the acting director of the NIH said that they can resume, which is wonderful. But it's not just clinical research that is part of the drug discovery pipeline, right? And so I think that this pause can be, without a doubt, very damaging.
Crystal Starbird of the University of North Carolina. Before reaching the first academic rung that Crystal's on, scientists have to go through years of effectively research apprenticeships as postgraduates, postdoctoral researchers, research fellowships, all of them often dependent on short-term federal grants. John Kuntz is a fish ecologist in California who's been hoping to hear news from his application to a federal review panel.
I am kind of an interdisciplinary biogeochemist, so right now I'm working with some of the shark species out here in the estuary, looking at the chemistry in their tissues and being able to tell where they were moving for their whole life or what they were eating for their whole life. So we're doing that particularly with a shark species that has been on the decline in the estuary. So for conservation and management of the population, we need to look into this stuff.
Now, my impression from what you were saying on social media is that you're getting to that very critical stage of your career where you're moving from being a graduate student, where you're doing research and writing a PhD, to try and establish yourself in academic research.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of right on the barrier where I'm kind of out of funding coming up this semester. And so I put in an NSF postdoctoral proposal. Which all NSF review committees, not just for the postdoc, but for many grad student and right academic large grants are now being postponed, and so we just don't really know what's going on.
Just explain that. So you have to fill in pages, what of saying what you hope to do, how you hope to do it, what your experience is. It's quite onerous.
Yeah. So just the proposal itself is around a 10-page proposal, but there's about 12 different documents you need to work with. You're also needing a whole team around you that they have to put in documentation. And so it's kind of wrangling everyone together to kind of get this proposal off the ground in a very short time span.
Had you done all that?
Yes. So that was put in October. Usually what happens is the first of the year, they start the grant review process for these panels that have now been paused. And then we usually find out March through May if you were to receive one, at least for the postdoctoral fellowship, which then will set you up for a summer or fall starting a 2-year position.
So the review panel, what is it? Has it actually not convened to look at your stuff, or is it that you don't know?
Yeah, so they have pretty much just sent out as of yesterday, they pretty much only said that it's been paused to make sure the review process is in the purview of the new executive orders. And so our understanding of that is that now the finish line is kind of moving down the line, right? We're not really sure what the rules are. And so the rules that we submitted to in October have now kind of changed. The goalposts have changed, I should say.
So what's that mean for you then? Because we don't know how long this pause is going to be, but are you sort of not funded at the moment? I'm wondering, are you going to be unpaid for this work at some point soon?
Yeah, so I pretty much have funding until May. After that, I'm trying to find a position. It's still a golden ticket trying to get. There's so much great competition. Also, too, a tangential bit, at least for myself, but all federal hiring is currently frozen, except for military. And so that was pretty much half of the jobs that I was going to be applying for outside of a postdoc was federal, working for the U.S. Geological Survey, NOAA, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
How far down the training route, how long have you been doing this kind of science, but as a researcher, but also as a student, as maybe as a volunteer?
Yeah, so I was doing some research in undergrad around a decade ago, And then I worked for 3 years as a technician, and then I've been in my PhD. I'm in the fifth year of my PhD now.
That's a lot of training.
It is. It's an interesting concept, right? Putting so much time and effort into a degree that I think is for the betterment of the country and the world with science, and then getting to the end of a PhD and kind of getting the rug pulled out from under you.
John Kuntz of Merced University in California. So there you have an individual instance of the disruptive effects of decisions already made in the White House. But at the national scale, the biggest attention has been paid to the US's plan to withdraw from the World Health Organization, and also instructions stopping federal agencies talking to the WHO, and what looks like an attack on the National Institutes of Health, founded in 1940 by President Roosevelt, and also the Center for Disease Control, related perhaps to their work during the pandemic. Lawrence Gostin is Professor of Global Health Law at Georgetown University and directs their WHO Center on National and Global Health Law. His assessment is excoriating.
NIH is literally the engine that has made America great. Nothing less than that. It's not just the dozens of Nobel Prizes. It's not just the incredible discoveries of genetic technologies and manipulating genes for better products or mRNA vaccines. It's cancer research, it's mental health, diabetes, and metabolic diseases. It's literally the engine that runs America, because for every dollar we invest in the NIH, we get countless dollars in productivity, lives saved. I believe that the NIH, hands down, is the envy of the world. The idea that NIH is there to kind of force people to do things that they don't want to do or should be a target of the so-called medical freedom campaign is nothing short of ridiculous.
I mean, immediately there seems to be a number of different policies which have come through which are affecting the NIH. Can you just unpick them a little for me? I mean, there was a funding freeze that's half suspended or what?
Well, there's a number of things that have gone on. It's really quite dizzying. President Trump ordered a freeze on all federal funding, which included NIH grants, say, for cancer research, just to give you an example. I've heard just now that he's rescinded the freeze. So presumably, NIH grants and activities can go on. But he hasn't undone the communications freeze. I'm on several NIH scientific committees, and I've been told, don't do anything further. And I would reply, is this because of the White House order and there's radio silence? So it's very clear to me that there's quite a lot of disruption. I mean, in the past, there was also a lot of controversy around NIH's funding of research indirectly of the Wuhan Institute of Virology just before the COVID pandemic. The NIH and all of its various institutes and centers have been really hammered over many years. I used to say NIH has escaped political gravity because they were loved by the Republicans and the Democrats. But now, basically, the Republicans are take no prisoners. You know, it's the CDC, it's the NIH, it's the FDA. There's nothing good that's coming out of this. I mean, for me, this is an assault on science. And you know, science isn't perfect. You know, it doesn't always get things right. It moves incrementally. But it's the only method that we have to try to advance the public's health, well-being, and safety. And we have to stand up for science at a time like this.
I mean, you say that some of the funding has been unfrozen again. But, you know, earlier in the week, I was seeing stories of people saying that they weren't even able to order ordinary reagents to keep the experiments going in their labs. And I mean, was that intended? Was that a misunderstanding? How did this happen?
I mean, I've been asked this a lot. You know, it's one of two things, and they're both equally bad, and there's probably a combination of both. One of them, I think there was deliberate ambiguity in many of these executive orders.
So that would be the messaging from the very top. Was
messaging from the president, even in the legal wording of them, and I've been working with a team of lawyers on challenging some of this, is deliberately ambiguous. And so it's impossible to tell. In fact, my group has just submitted a whole range of questions to the Senate, just basic factual questions. What does this mean when you freeze funding? Or what does it mean when you withdraw from WHO? Is it now? What does it mean when you put a pause on all communications and scientific committees? So that's one thing. The other is that I really don't think that the Trump administration has thought any of this through.
I mean, the fact that it was done so quickly suggests that to me.
Yeah, it suggests it to me as well. I mean, I think it's just basically, you know, you elected me to be a disruptor. I'm going to tear things down. That's what he's doing.
Are you getting to talk to any of the leadership at NIH or even their staff to get a sense of what they're hearing and what their concerns are?
Oh, yeah, sure. CDC and FDA as well. You know, I can say there is a huge pull over these agencies. You know, one of the things I've noticed about this administration is that they like to caricature people, these remote, faceless bureaucrats at NIH or CDC or the World Health Organization. But I know these people. They don't always get it right. None of us do. But they're doctors, nurses, epidemiologists, virologists, and other scientists that get up every day with the idea that they're going to try to make this world and America a little bit safer and a little bit healthier. That's their goal. And they do it for very little money and very little recognition.
There's a separate issue which has also come up, but I presume it's all related. It's not just withdrawing from the World Health Organization, either now or at the end of the year, as I understand it, but a bar on communications with the organization, which presumably is not just America telling WHO what it knows, but WHO feeding information into research institutions. Give me a sense of what damage that could do.
It's nuts, really. It really is. I mean, there are a number of things WHO does that are absolutely vital to American national security interests. One of them is that they coordinate a vast network of laboratories, scientists, public health agencies. They collect surveillance data, epidemiological data. They share pathogen samples, genomic sequencing data that are absolutely vital. If a CDC official can't talk to the World Health Organization, he or she is not going to know about novel outbreaks on the ground, not going to be able to prepare America for them or to partner with WHO to put out those fires before they get to the United States. But even more, our NIH, our scientists, our pharmaceutical industry needs this information to know where to invest in research and development and to help speed access to vaccines and treatments. And America acting alone without scientists around the world is basically just alone, vulnerable, fragile, and unprepared.
You do sound extraordinarily depressed about the situation.
Yeah, I am. It's not only because I've worked in this field for many, many decades, ever since the first days of the AIDS pandemic. And it's not just because I have a long history with NIH, CDC, and WHO, and I know the people. It's really the idea that this is fomenting public distrust in science and public health itself. You know, Trump put out about 100 executive orders on his first day in office. Many of them were very consequential about climate change and about immigration. But flying under the radar was all of the bombs thrown at science and public health and global health. I think this is enormously damaging.
Health scholar Lawrence Gostin. These days, the rising challenger to US scientific dominance is China, as exemplified by the startling success of the AI DeepSeek, AI being the current public face of cutting-edge science. 70 years ago, the ideological battle was with the Soviet Union and was exemplified by the space race. The surprise launch of Sputnik in 1957 showed then-Republican President Eisenhower the US had been caught napping.
The Soviet Union now has, in the combined category of scientists and engineers, a greater number than the United States. We need scientists. In the 10 years ahead, they say we need them by thousands more than we're now presently planning to have. The federal government can deal with only part of this difficulty, but it must and will do its part. The task is a cooperative one. Federal, state, and local governments, and our entire citizenry must all do their share.
Quite a contrast to the language used last week in an executive order re-establishing the Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST.
Today, across science, medicine, and technology, ideological dogmas have surfaced that elevate group identity above individual achievement, enforce conformity at the expense of innovative ideas, and inject politics into the heart of the scientific method. These agendas have not only distorted truth, but have eroded public trust, undermined the integrity of research, stifled innovation, and weakened America's competitive edge.
Whether scientists will be inspired by the actions of the past week to restore that competitive edge does remain to be seen. We'll be keeping an eye out here on Science in Action from the BBC World Service. But we're also keen to talk plain science rather than the politics of it, as I hope you'll hear next week. But for now, that's it from me, Ronan Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.